Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is United States versus Kapp. Mr. Kamen.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Well, this case is about genetics. The government decided that certain animals should be considered endangered so that they can be protected. And then the question became what animals would be protected and genetically what animals ought to be preserved. In other words, there became a hybrid question. And there was a question of whether only purebreds were to be protected, whether hybrids should be protected if they looked like the purebreds. A lot of questions were raised. The policy became that if one species was listed and one wasn't listed, then the offspring of that was a hybrid. Wasn't protected under the Endangered Species Act, was not endangered. Then the government decided that sanctions should be created if certain activities were undertaken in regards to these endangered animals, if they were in fact the animals were considered endangered. But somehow the prosecution was never required to prove that the animals were in fact endangered, even though that was one of the elements of the violation under the Endangered Species Act.
I have to say, this whole argument of yours strikes me as a little otherworldly. I mean, first, there was never any question about the leopards, the Panthera pardus, if you will. There was no subspecies point there. And secondly, with respect to the tigers, there was really no question that both the statute and the regulations protect at the species level, not at the subspecies level, Panthera tigris. And the fact that hypothetically maybe there could be such a thing as a liger really didn't come up very much. Indeed, you in your brief concede that these are notably different in appearance from a tiger, and the fact that there may be subspecies of tigers is quite beside the point. There may not be. Apparently there's some genetic debate about that, but it really doesn't matter given the structure of the statute.
Exhibit A of my brief, footnote at the very end, I believe it is, discusses the purebred issue. And the question really is whether we take the view from the top down or we take the view from the bottom up.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say the question is, in terms of the statutory of law that this court is bound to follow, what does the statute say? What are the implementing regulations, such as 50 CFR section 17.11G and 17.11 in its entirety? Those are the governing sources of law. As you're, I'm sure, well aware, the Supreme Court has drawn a distinction between regulations that are promulgated through the normal procedures and more informal forms of agency guidance. So it's really not dispositive what may have been said in various flyers or not, what it might have meant or what it might not have meant. The regulation, which is cited in the government's brief at page 21, quite clearly says the listing of a particular taxon includes all lower taxonomic units.
Well, I guess the question then would become, what is the lower taxonomic unit of a Panthera tigris if you take I don't really know the Latin very well, but...
No, but it doesn't matter. I mean, look, you can't dispute the fact that we all understand under the Linnaean system of classification what a genus is, what a species is, and what a subspecies is. And a particular taxon, such as the regulation says, a genus, has under it various other classifications. I mean, you know, this argument of yours, I really think... is grasping at straws. I mean, there is a species, tiger, Pantheris tigris, and Mr. Kapp knew perfectly well that that's what he was dealing with. That's what he calls them. That's what they look like. That's what the government's exhibits were. There was no hybridization issue here, and certainly not. You're not even arguing there was with the leopards. Are you? You are not making a hybrid argument vis-a-vis the leopards.
I am, actually. Well,
no, I don't see it anywhere. There's no evidence that there's any hybrid leopard.
The hybrid issue applies to each... I mean, the definition is...
Where is your evidence? What possible argument did you make anywhere that there was a hybrid leopard involved in any of this activity? The government showed they were leopards. If you didn't think they were leopards, you had to say something, or else there would be zero evidence.
I made the general point of plants and animals, and if the prosecution brings up...
But the government had an expert testify as to what these specimens were. And you can't just sit there and say, I want more evidence. They have an expert morphologist who's testifying about what they were. That was plenty of evidence for a jury to conclude that they were indeed what this expert said they were.
I mean, the question, I guess, becomes, can a morphologist who's an expert at looking at an animal and saying, this is a tiger, this is a leopard, can an expert look at the leopard and determine what the subspecies of the leopard
is? But you never argued that she had to. You never make that argument. She testifies it's a leopard. She's an expert. You don't make a Rule 702 or a Daubert argument about her expertise. She knows a leopard when she sees one. She says it's a leopard. A jury, under the standards of review we have, can conclude that that's enough to show that it's a leopard, not to mention the fact that they can see, as you objected to, but they it certainly underscores the relevance of the exhibits, they can see for themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, can you see a subspecies?
You don't need to. You don't. The subspecies with leopard has nothing to do with this case. You never argued that there were subspecies. At least tigers. There are Bengal tigers and Siberian tigers and other kinds of tigers. But you never make that argument.
I guess if... I guess they're talking about a hybrid. The government is acknowledging that a hybrid exists, that a hybrid is not protected...
No, they don't acknowledge that at all, because there are subspecies, perhaps subspecies hybrids, which they say certainly are protected, and they make the point that under your theory, not a single tiger on the planet is protected. Seems a little extreme. Now, if it's a liger or a tigon or one of these cross-species hybrids, they agree, but there's no evidence that that's the only kind of animal Mr. Kapp was killing and otherwise, you know, selling the meat of, tanning, etc.
Well, I guess then if you go back one generation, you're talking about a tigon or a tigon.
No. There were tigers. There's testimony that they're tigers and leopards. That's what he was dealing with. And I don't understand why he was doing this or why he thought he could falsify records. about how he was getting them, but he certainly was dealing with this. And it seems to me, if I were you, you might want to turn to your sentencing points.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure where you mean, Your Honor.
I thought you were making some arguments about the sentence he received as well as the fundamental.
Under Booker.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry.
The sentence was near the top of the guidelines range.
Well, the sentence was near the top of the guidelines range after after the judge found a series of facts.
And was there or was there not a Booker type argument made in the district court?
I just argued one point. I argued leader organizer, that there was not evidence of leader organizer. She found that under the guidelines that he was a leader organizer.
So the answer is no, and our review is for plain error. And how does this sentencing proceeding qualify as plain error?
Well, I guess this court held that prior to the Supreme Court's finding that because of the huge change in the federal sentencing brought on by Booker, that the plain error was inherent in...
No, we didn't. Plain error was not raised in the Booker decision that came to this court before the Supreme Court's Booker decision. We are now in whatever world the Supreme Court has established after January 12th, 2005, and that's really what you need to focus on, I think, to answer Judge Sykes' question. I mean, you filed a supplemental brief about it.
Maybe to focus you a little bit here, how is it that a sentence at the top of the guidelines range would qualify as plain error? How does it affect the defendant's substantial rights and also affect the fairness and integrity, seriously affect the fairness and integrity and public reputation of the proceedings?
Well, obviously, I mean, if he's going to receive a six-month, the defendant's going to receive a six-month sentence, and suddenly he receives a 51-month sentence, I believe that clearly qualifies as a substantial miscarriage of justice if he doesn't, if this sentence isn't reviewed based on the new constitutional law. And I mean, it seems pretty clear that he would receive a sentence somewhat higher than 6 points that it will now translated into the judge's discretion. But the question is, would he receive such a high sentence? The traditional mitigation evidence was not even relevant to the guideline sentencing, and it would be if there was a remand for resentencing. So then the question would be, is he getting 51 months or something?
I think there's a possibility if the case went back, the district judge might give you less than he did under the sentencing.
Considerably less. And if he's receiving considerably less, then, I mean, that's a clear difference, and that's would be a clear, I guess, a significant enough difference that I believe it would be plain error.
What evidence is there that he would receive considerably less?
Well, I guess
if the district judge was inclined to sentence at the top of the applicable guidelines range, that seems to indicate that there isn't any.
We can speculate as to how she would sentence him on remand. I'm not certain that she would sentence him if she had the discretion to that point, or she felt that she needed to sentence him based on the I mean, whatever her calculus was, I really don't know. It would be interpreting her psychology. I'm really not sure. Your Honors, if I can reserve some time. Thank you.
Yes.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. Your Honor, the defendant in this case was fairly convicted based on an absolute avalanche of evidence that demonstrated quite clearly that the animals that he killed, bought, sold, and transported were all endangered tigers and leopards, and also that the defendant well knew this fact. I would also describe the argument that's been raised regarding hybridization as being grasping at straws, and really that's all that was available given the breadth and depth of the evidence that was available to the government in this case. As Your Honors has pointed out, the evidence included the expert testimony of a highly qualified forensic morphologist, as well as the mounts and skins and a couple of skulls of the animals themselves. In addition, there was a wealth of circumstantial evidence, including documentation prepared by the defendant, recorded telephone calls in which the defendant referred to the animals as tigers and leopards, as well as eyewitness testimony of a multitude of witnesses who all testified not only that the defendant described the animals as tigers and leopards, but also that stated that the defendant did not use the term hybrids in any way. Finally, there was substantial evidence that the defendant was well aware of the existence of an animal, a crossbreed called a liger, and that he knew the difference between a liger and a tiger. He discussed this fact in a couple of recorded telephone calls, including one with an undercover agent posing as an interior designer. In addition, the skin of a liger was recovered from the defendant's property, and Ms. Yates, the expert forensic morphologist, identified this skin as the skin of a hybrid tiger-liger, also known as a liger. Moving on to the sentencing argument, if Your Honors have no more questions about the substantive arguments, the government contends that the defendant cannot meet the plein air test, which is applicable in this case for the following reasons.
Before we get into that, we've, as you, I'm sure, are well aware, I've been hearing quite a few of these arguments from the government of late. And I'd like to start with the question that Judge Sykes was asking, maybe from a somewhat different point of view. Certainly the district judge here chose a sentence at the upper end of the guideline range as she computed it. But the guideline range itself structured that decision-making that she made, as it was supposed to, of course. And as Mr. Kamen said before he sat down, we really don't know whether she would have conceived of this as either a wider range or a narrower range had she been in the post-Booker discretionary world. Given that lack of knowledge, how can we have any confidence that there is there's not error here?
Well, I would agree that we cannot know for certain what the district court would have done in the post-Booker world. That's just not something that's knowable. But there are two factors that ought to govern the analysis of this issue. One of them is the evidence that is present in the record, which it does include a sentence at the top of the guideline range, but also it includes very serious statements by the district court judge at the time of sentencing that emphasize the seriousness of the defendant's conduct, the defendant's lack of remorse, and the aspects of the crime that the court felt were very, very serious. And I don't recall the term she used, but it may have been despicable. What you can tell from the record is that the court considered this a very serious crime and the defendant's conduct to be the worst that it could be under the strictures of the guideline. And
well,
I should agree.
Maybe not the worst, because, of course, she could have departed upward. She was below the statutory
well,
maximum.
The worst that it could be within the guideline is what
I just said. But here's one thing that I've been wondering. Suppose we were to suppose we were to do something similar to what the Second Circuit has adopted in the Crosby case, which I realize you have your footnotes that you don't like, but you know, we ask the district court judge, would you do something different if you had discretion? And the district judge says, you bet I would. I would go higher. What then? Is that something that should only be open if the government has somehow cross-appealed, or is that something that the defendant risks by asking that a sentence be vacated for resentencing under the new Booker regime?
Well, we have talked about the possibility of something like a Second Circuit remand. I believe that the most recent arguments have focused on the type of remand that would be much like you describe, a request, a certification of the question, essentially, what would you have done had you not been constrained by the guidelines? In my judgment, the defendant definitely risks the possibility of a higher sentence by raising this issue. There are no issues with respect to obtaining or imposing a higher sentence if the case is ultimately remanded. And we would say that if the question's asked and that answer is given, that's evidence that the third prong was met.
Well, at that point, though, what happens? Do we just stay with the original sentence on the ground that there was no plain error, at least, in imposing the original sentence if the district judge says, in fact, I would have gone right up to the statutory ceiling? Or does it get vacated for just a brand new sentencing hearing, at which point all the 3553A factors come in, the government comes back and talks about how heinous it all was, and he comes back and says, no, you know, et cetera?
I think you've met the third prong, and if you've met the third prong, and especially if the judge says I'd send him at the top of the statutory ceiling, that difference, I think, would be something that would likely meet the fourth prong as well. The question...
But by that, do you mean that we would then affirm the original sentence, or that he would actually be resentenced? Obviously, from his point of view, 120 months, which I think is the ceiling here, is worse than 96.
Well, he did not receive 96 months, and I don't recall when you stack the statutes what the sentence, what the actual ceiling is. You may be right that it's 120.
Or whatever it is. I mean, but he was not, as I recall, anyway, we have all these cases, but as I recall, he's not at the statutory ceiling.
That's right. That's okay. Right. He's not.
And so if
because
the
there are
judge,
so many counts.
Right. But if the district judge were to go up, or if the district judge were to say, on something like what the Second Circuit was contemplating, I think the sentence should be higher, as a matter of fact. My question for you is the right thing for this court to do simply to affirm the existing sentence on the ground that it's certainly not plain error to have imposed the existing sentence if in a discretionary world she thought even more was called for? Or is there a whole new sentencing proceeding at which he risks even more time?
Well, I don't think that plain error is necessarily limited to a sentence that's too high. But let me go further. I don't think that you'll ever reach that point, and here's why. If you were to put into place this kind of structure and you certified the question to the district court, and the district court came back and said, you bet I would, I'd give him the highest sentence I possibly could, before you had an opportunity, I think, to just make a final determination on plain error and remand the case, the defendant would be in here pulling the appeal. So I truly don't think that this is anything more than an academic exercise if that's the kind of procedure that you decide to implement.
But actually, you think because of that ability on the part of the defendant, the de facto ceiling on this sentence, however we get there, is what it now is.
Yes, but I don't think that it is because of the legal analysis that's required under the plain error test. I think it is just de facto. That would be
because of the defendant's ability to pull the appeal.
Right. Now, and there would be a difference, as you point out, if there was a cross appeal.
Oh, sure.
That defendant would not have that opportunity.
Right.
So that defendant is really taking a risk.
Right.
Unless upon pulling the defendant's appeal, the government decided
there was some
the
agreement to
right.
do them both. Yeah.
So as I understand it, then you say that it was virtually an exercise. Well, maybe not in futility. At least we would know what the district court thought, but that'd be the end of the appeal, then, right? If it were higher, I mean, if the district.
I would presume so. I mean, I can't imagine that defendants would go forward even in light of a statement like that from the district court. So I do think, as a de facto matter, that's what would happen. Now, this case, I think, as Judge Sykes pointed out, poses a unique problem because there is evidence in the record that suggests that the defendant cannot meet the burden of showing that his sentence would have been lower but for the existence of the guidelines. I do think that a sentence at the top of the range has meaning. It may not be an absolute statement about what the sentence would have been, but it does suggest the likelihood that the sentence would not have gone lower. And I also think that a sentence within the applicable guideline range, given the history of the guidelines and how they were developed, is not the kind of sentence that, on its face, without clear evidence that the evidence would have, or that the sentence would have been lower, is sufficient to meet the fourth prong, because it simply does not threaten the integrity, fairness, or public reputation of the proceedings. If Your Honors have no further questions, I'll step down.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you. We would ask, of course, that the defendant's conviction and sentence be affirmed in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Bamici. Mr. Kamen?
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time? You have 1 minute, Mr. Kamen.
The question of what the defendant knew, I mean, that, he couldn't possibly know. It's the same thing as what the subspecies are, assuming that there is a hybrid of the subspecies, and I believe there's plenty of evidence upon research to see that there is a hybrid of the subspecies, that's throughout the Department of Interior discussing what it ought to do about hybrids from the very beginning, and it never changed its position. Apparently now it has a different position. According to the government, it has a different position. It did not have a different position we don't have any proof that it had a different position in 1997. And again, in the trial, the government had the burden of proof, and I don't believe it met that burden of proof. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Proceed to the second case.